Alrighty, we are underway, and session six will start on page 35 of your notebook. Before we get there, though, I have a little bit of a review. Before we get actually into the review, I've just finished reading this book. We talked about replacement theology recently, and this is a very short but very efficient book dealing with replacement theology. Has the Church Replaced Israel? By Michael J. Vlach. Especially helpful areas are the history of replacement theology and how allegorism and the allegorical interpretation entered the church and has remained in the church up until recently. So this is a worthwhile book getting for your library if you're interested in it. So I would recommend it. It fits in with our class very nicely in that it explains replacement theology very succinctly. Now, I was telling you last week, we talked about three versions of this story about the infallible proof of God's existence, and we referred it to Ezekiel 36, where God says, I'm going to vindicate my name by bringing the Jewish people out of their worldwide dispersion to their own land. And that vindicates who God is, what he's like, his very existence. So I said it was a good Ezekiel 36 was a good apologetic, and then I shared with you these three versions of the same story. What's the infallible proof of God's existence? The Jew, sir, the Jew. So this is the Disraeli version, which we looked at, and then we also looked at the Kaiser version, and I also mentioned to you that I've seen a Tsar version. Russian emperor. And guess what? Guess what? Just this week, I was finishing up reading this book, Christ's Prophetic Plans, which, by the way, is another worthwhile book getting. It's a kind of a primer on eschatology from a conservative dispensational point of view. But in this book, Christ's Prophetic Plans, I came across a fourth version of this story. All right? Here it is. On page 79 and 80, you read, over 200 years ago, Frederick II, the great king of Prussia, so this is the Frederick II version, discussed with his chaplain the truth of the Bible. The king had become skeptical about Christianity, largely through the influence of the French atheist Voltaire. So he said to his chaplain, if your Bible is really true, it ought to be capable of a very easy proof. So often when I've asked for proof of the inspiration of the Bible, I have been given some large tome that I have neither the time nor the desire to read. If your Bible is really from God, you should be able to demonstrate the fact simply. Give me proof that the inspiration of the Bible in a word. The chaplain replied, Your Majesty, it is possible for me to answer your question literally. I can give you the proof you ask for in one word. Frederick was amazed at his response. What is this magic word that carries such a weight of proof, he asked. Israel, said the chaplain. Frederick was silent. So there you go. Version number four of the same story. You know, a little bit different, but it's, I don't know the truth of all these stories, but I do know that they do have a truth embedded in them, and that's the fact that the Jewish people are an apologetic for the existence of God. All righty. Then we talked about the blessings and cursings of the Mosaic Covenant. We talked about the blessings 2 weeks ago. We talked about the cursings last week. We saw that the history of the nation Israel is not characterized by obedience. Rather, it is characterized by disobedience and struggling with these curses of the Mosaic Covenant. For example, from the book of Judges through the Assyrian invasions, our history was characterized by sickness, harassment, insecurity, drought, famine, and wild animals. And there were a few moments of bright light, like under Solomon's reign, the early part of Solomon's reign. But in general, our enemies constantly harassed us, etc. Then the next curse was the horrors of siege experienced during the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions, followed by the Babylonian and Roman destructions and the curse of devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism. Then God explained the state of the land during a deportation, resting and desolate. And that state of the land was experienced after the Babylonian desolation for 70 years and the Roman destruction for approximately 2,000 years. The state of the people was then described, fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. Well, that did not happen after the Babylonian dispersion. We thrived in Babylon. We had a good time in Babylon. Very few Jews wanted to come back to Israel after living in Babylon. And there was a large Jewish community there even in the first century and beyond. But this is what we experienced after the Roman destruction. Fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. But then Leviticus 26 came to an end with a complete turnabout, the promise of restoration, peace, and an end of suffering. And of course, that's a reference to the Messianic kingdom. And I left a big gap there because one more dispersion remains. The Antichrist's tribulation diaspora awaits us. And so our class deals with the first regathering. It takes place between these two arrows. We are regathered now in unbelief in preparation for judgment. That judgment will be the judgment of the great tribulation. And out of that judgment, we will finally come to faith in Jesus the Messiah, and he will return and set up the Messianic kingdom. So we looked at the curses of the covenant. Then we also talked about the times of the Gentiles. The times of the Gentiles is characterized by Jerusalem being trodden down by the Gentiles until that period of time is fulfilled. So the times of the Gentiles extends from the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and the temple until the second coming. During that entire time period, and we're in the middle of it right now, Jerusalem has been trodden down by the Gentiles in a greater or lesser degree throughout this whole period of time, with maybe one exception during the Maccabean period. Then we talked about the principle of expansion, that if we obey the Lord, he will enlarge our borders to the full extent of the land blessing, you know, if we carefully observe all his commandments. And then we looked at the principle of contraction, and that was brought out by referring to Yehu, the very ungodly king, the disobedient king. And he disobeyed God, so the response, the Lord began to cut off portions from Israel. In other words, God will expand the blessings of the land covenant to the full promised borders if we obey him, but if we do not obey him, he will cut off the borders of the land and the blessing will be reduced until finally we're cast out of the land. And we saw how that principle of expansion and contraction worked itself out. First, with this chart dealing with the ancient possession of the land, you see our possession has gone up and down, increased and decreased throughout our history, both in the ancient times and in our modern times. And of course, our class deals with Zionism, the first worldwide regathering, and then we'll be covering all these other modern events as well. So that brings us now to page 35 of your workbook. And we start at the top of page 35 with point F. And I'm just going to run through some chronological events, a chronological sequence of events. This is just going to be a quick overview. If you want the details, go to Footsteps of the Messiah by Dr. Fruchtenbaum. We have copies up front here, but he goes through this in much more detail than I'm going to go through. As far as the prophetic events that fall in a chronological sequence, some of the events have taken place, some have not taken place, and there are some events we cannot locate chronologically. There's just not enough information. So regarding the events that have taken place, first of all, World War I and World War II. World War I actually marked the beginning of the birth pangs. Kingdom rising against kingdom, as Yeshua said, is a Jewish idiom for a world war. And the birth pangs would not begin until we saw a world war. So World War I began the end times and the birth pangs. World War I was also very important in the Jewish community because it provided the incentive for Zionism. We'll look at things like the Balfour Declaration that came out of World War I. But then World War II, which was really a continuation of World War I, had another very important effect on the Jewish community. Out of the Holocaust, it showed the need for Zionism. World War I, the incentive for Zionism. World War II showed us the need for Zionism. So those events have taken place. We're in the last days. The next thing that had to happen was the reestablishment of the state of Israel. Some of these prophecies could not be fulfilled unless there was a state, an independent entity known as the state of Israel in the land. Following that, Jerusalem had to come under Jewish control. Again, there are certain prophecies that could not come to pass unless the Jewish people controlled Jerusalem. So those are the events that have already taken place. Now, what about the events that have not taken place? The first one would be the Russian invasion of Israel, the Russian coalition's invasion. Following that, our world will experience a one-world government. It won't last very long, and it will change into a 10-division worldwide system, the 10 kingdoms, some kind of a 10-division worldwide system. Out of the 10-division worldwide system will rise the Antichrist. He will come out of those 10 kingdoms. Then there'll be a period of peace and false security, and finally, Antichrist will sign a 7-year covenant with Israel. And that 7-year covenant will begin the tribulation period. That's what begins the tribulation period, the signing of the 7-year covenant. We make a covenant with Satan's man, and God says, okay, you just stepped over the red line. You know, we hear a lot about red lines these days, and he will discipline us and finally bring us to faith. But there are events that the Russian invasion of Israel here being the next major prophetic event that we should anticipate. And then there are events that cannot be chronologically arranged. First of all, the rapture of the church. That could happen any moment. That could happen before I'm done with this class. It could happen in 20 years. We just don't know. Be ready, right? Of course, right. Be ready. Secondly, there's a worldwide blackout predicted. We don't know when this will happen, but no light will come to the earth from sun, moon, and stars. How long it will last, when it will occur, there's no comments in Scripture other than it will happen before the tribulation period. And finally, the return of Elijah. Elijah must come before the great and terrible day of the Lord. Again, we don't know when. 5 minutes before that covenant is signed? 5 years? 50 years? We just don't know. But Elijah will return. The third temple needs to be built. Now, all we know is that it has to be up and functioning by the middle of the tribulation. That's all we know. They could start building it tomorrow. It could be done in a year or two. We don't know when it will be built. All we know is that by the middle of the tribulation, it's functioning. So the third temple, we can't place chronologically. So that's the events that you can anticipate and look for. Question, yes?
The terrible day of the Lord is referring to the entire tribulation period?
Yes, that's a reference to the tribulation period, yes. The entire 7 years. Yep. All righty. Now move down to page 35G, Islam. So my final introductory topic is the topic of Islam. Now I'm not an expert on Islam. I don't want to be an expert on Islam. But I've included a short article for you about Islam. And it's an important introductory article to know about because Islam has a very important impact on the modern state. Islam is the most obvious persecutor of the Jewish people today. So you need to know something about it. Now, please note what I am not saying. I am not saying that Islam is prophesied in the Bible. It is not. It is not. It is not one of the four kingdoms. It is not the fourth kingdom. Okay? Rome is the fourth kingdom. Secondly, I'm not saying that the Antichrist is going to be a Muslim or anything like that. So don't read anything like that into this article. Those subjects belong to a study of eschatology. That's not what we're doing. I'm simply supplying you with an article so you can understand who the preeminent enemy of Israel happens to be at the present time. So turn to page 36. And this was put together by Sudan Interior Mission, SIM, a number of years ago. It's not the newest article, but I think it was written in 19. But I've had it for quite a while. It's still true. It's just facts about the Muslim faith. So page 36, what is Islam? Page 37, a little bit on Islamic life. Page 37, a religion of contrasts. page 38, the holy places of Islam. Page 38, a little bit about Muhammad and the expansion of Islam. And on page 39, the article comes to an end. So feel free to go ahead and read that and familiarize yourself with Islam. Now, page 39, H. I'm going to share with you some rabbinic thoughts about the modern state. And these rabbinic thoughts come from this book called The Talmudic Anthology by Lewis Newman. So if you're interested in some of the comments of the rabbis on many different topics, this is a good a book to read. You don't have to buy the encyclopedia-sized Talmud to get these thoughts. They've been culled out for you. But there's some interesting thoughts here. Drop down to, turn to the next page. The first quote at the top of page 40, Menachot 53. Here's what the rabbis write. Why is Israel like an olive? As the olive gives its oil only by being crushed, so does Israel repent only through chastisements. He's got it, doesn't it? He understands the curses of the covenant. See, all I've been teaching you is not outside the Jewish community. Here, this is exactly what the rabbis understand as well. And down a few more to... down about three quotes to Nedarim 49. Israel is like a vine. A vine is trodden underfoot. And again, there, he's speaking there of the wine press where you toss the grapes into the wine press and crush them. A vine is trodden underfoot, but later its wine is placed on the table of the king. So does Israel, at first oppressed, come to greatness. And that's our history. It's been thousands of years of oppression, but eventually we will enter into the Messianic Kingdom. Sanhedrin 104, just below that. Those who persecute Israel are unwearying. Right? Boy, it never ends. It never ends. And finally, Esther Rabbah 6:5. That's actually from the Midrash. That's not actually from the Talmud. It's from the Midrash. As the myrtle is sweet to him who smell it, but bitter to him who bites into it, so Israel brings prosperity to the nation which grants them kindness and depression to the people who afflicts them with evil. Now that's another way to word the Abrahamic covenant, right? Genesis 12:3. I will bless those that bless you and curse those who curse you. Just a little more poetic way of saying that. So what I'm teaching you is not outside the Jewish community. This isn't weird stuff. This is straight Bible. And the rabbis that believe the Bible and actually read it understand exactly what we're talking about here. All righty. So that's some rabbinic thoughts about the modern state. You can read some of the other ones on your own. So on the top of page 41, just a little practical application. First of all, always remember that Zionism is not subjective. Yes, there's subjective emotion associated with it. But Zionism is backed by objective biblical support. So if you're a Zionist, I would suggest you defend the Jewish right to the land from the scriptures we've talked about. Defend the Jewish right to the land and the idea of a Jewish homeland from the biblical support that I've just presented. Now, all other arguments contain a limited amount of clout. All other arguments are simply man's social, political, and economic thinking. You know, economic reasoning and man's social, political, and economic reasoning changes as easily as the breeze. Here today and gone tomorrow. But what about the Word of God? The Word of God is a firm anchor that can never be moved. Isaiah 40, verse 8. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the Word of our God stands forever. The Bible's been around for 4,000 years. It'll continue forever. So count on it. You know, man's reasons are the grass and the flowers. But God and his revelation is a rock, a mountain that we can depend on. So Zionism and the Jewish return to our homeland is an important ingredient in the plan of God for the world. So be prepared to defend that from the scriptures. Now in the middle of page 41, I do just a little bit of a theological summary for us. And this theological summary answers the question, why the unending struggle in the Middle East? Well, there are five factors that come into play. First of all, there's a religious war in progress. It's Islamic paganism against biblical truth. Simple as that. There is a religious war going on today, no matter what our government says. Secondly, there's the personal war of Satan against God. Satan is desperately trying to save himself. You see, when the Abrahamic covenant is fulfilled, his career is over, and he'll be cast into the lake of fire. That's his final abode forever. Now, he tried to attack the spiritual blessing promise of the Abrahamic covenant by killing Yeshua. And what did that do? That only fulfilled it. And Yeshua instituted the new covenant through his life, death, and resurrection, A.D. 30. So now he's trying to attack the other two legs of the Abrahamic covenant. That's the national promise and the land promise. So he's trying to destroy the Jewish people or destroy the nation of Israel. So we are involved in a personal war of Satan against God. Thirdly, the Abrahamic covenant. There's been promises made to the Jewish people. If the Abrahamic covenant can be perverted or prevented from being fulfilled, then God is shown to be weak and a liar because he cannot keep his promises. So the glory of God is wrapped up in the Abrahamic covenant. The character of God is a fundamental component to the Abrahamic covenant. That's why he says, I'm going to vindicate my name by fulfilling the Abrahamic covenant. And that's why the handout I gave to you, why what's at stake, is so important. So read Barry Leventhal's article there. What's at stake here? Everything is at stake. Fourthly, the discipline of the Mosaic covenant is in play due to Jewish disobedience. We're suffering from the curses of the covenant today. Well, at this point in time, I was asked via email from a student that's taking the class, on the East Coast, and she asked a very common question. So I thought, well, maybe I better share this. I've been asked this at least three or four times. I'm sure there are more people that are asking this question, so I need to make sure I'm clear here. The question she asked me, if the Mosaic covenant is no longer in effect, why are the curses on Israel still operating? And the answer is this. The Mosaic covenant has been rendered inoperative for those of us who have accepted Yeshua as Savior and live under the new covenant. Okay? He instituted the new covenant in A.D. 30. Those of you who are Gentile believers are grafted in to that new covenant. That's your portal into the Abrahamic blessings. However, unbelieving Israel as a nation has not entered into the new covenant. Most individual Jews have not come to faith in Yeshua and his new covenant. Individual Jews like myself have, but not the nation as a whole. That awaits the end of the tribulation and the fulfillment of Romans 11:25 through 29, when all Israel is saved. Now the new covenant is embraced by grace through faith. Jew or Gentile, it's all the same. There's no distinction in regard to salvation. We all come to salvation. We all enter into the new covenant by grace through faith. As a result, the Mosaic covenant is still the rule of life for unbelieving Israel. Therefore, the blessings and cursings of the covenant are still in effect for unbelieving Israel today. Not for us, but for unbelieving Israel. Does that make sense? Okay, so pray that the nation will come to faith and enter into the new covenant. All righty. And finally, number five, point five. The fifth point I make is that prophecy must be fulfilled. For example, the times of the Gentiles. Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. All right, that brings us to page 43. Turn your page. And now we come to Roman numeral number two. We've moved out of the introductory biblical section, and we're getting into the actual history of the modern state of Israel. So, what I think I'll do right now, this is a good time to give you your break. Take your break, and I'll get set up for section number two. We've finished the spiritual war, and now, let's see, is this going to be it? I didn't test myself. Anyway, I've got a second a second section to put up on the screen. So we're going to now start the background. So to go ahead and take your break, and we'll pick it up right after the break. All right, we're underway again. We're on page 43 of your workbook, Roman numeral 2. We're going to take a very quick historical survey of the period from 66 AD to 1839. And the period is characterized by continuous Jewish presence in the land. Oh, let's pick it up here. Now, and this here, this little map here, halfway between Svat or Safed on the right side of the map and Nahariya on the coast, the left side of the map, sits the little town of Pekin. And you can find a synagogue near the entrance to this little town. That synagogue is a very ancient structure. It claims that two of the carved stones in its walls once belonged to the Herodian temple itself in Jerusalem. Now, the Zainati family worships there, and they trace their origin back to the first century as well. The family members note with pride that they are the only Jews in the land of Israel whose ancestors lived uninterruptedly in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, since the first century. And they are correct. They are authentic. This family has been checked out. So these Jews are the embodiment of a physical Jewish connection with the land that was never totally cut. The Romans may have laid the entire nation waste between AD 70 and AD 135, slaughtering between 600,000 and 1,356,000 Jewish people, and carrying off between 101,700 to 300,000 slaves. Yet in the aftermath of that monumental dispersion, a few thousand Jews somehow remained in the country, heavily taxed, denied the right to visit Jerusalem. The survivors made their homes in Galilee, farming the land and working their trades. And they remained. They remained, they married, they raised families up to this very day. Question? No. No, I don't know what tribe they're from, even if they can identify it. The point I want to make is that the modern state of Israel did not really begin in 1948. The modern state of Israel is a nation whose heritage spans the 2,000-year gap between the first century and 1948. So the point I want to stress is the fact that the Jewish people may have been dispersed from the land and the nation ceased to be recognized as a political entity. Yet Jewish people have lived in the land for the entire length of the dispersion. So we'll be looking at the modern state of Israel in this class. As we do, we need to keep in mind that we're not studying the birth of a nation as though it was newly created. Instead, we're studying the resurrection of a nation that's been beaten up and trodden down, but a nation that's been in existence for some 4,000 years. Now, we'll start at a particular point in time and look at the rise of the modern state. We're only doing that because of the limitations of the class. Yes, Bonnie.
Is there any verified history that to
return
after the Exodus?
Verified history?
Of their presence in the land.
At the Exodus?
Yeah.
Yeah, archaeology is finding more and more evidence of that. Yeah. Oh, sure. All right, so the history of the modern state does not begin with Zionism in 1839. The history of the modern state continues with Zionism. So we're going to do an extremely brief historical overview of the land of Israel from the first century to the rise of Zionism. So let's start on page 44, and we'll go for the Roman period, 66 to 634. In AD 66, the Jews of Israel rose in revolt against the Roman Empire in an effort to free their homeland from the Roman rule. Jerusalem fell. The temple was destroyed in AD 70, and it took approximately two more years of mopping up operations to finish the job. With the capture of the Dead Sea stronghold at Masada in 70 AD, the war against Rome came to an end. Now, a strong Jewish presence remained in the land, especially in the Galilee. In AD 132, Emperor Hadrian published new restrictive laws against the Jewish religion. In addition, he decided to build a new city on the ruins of destroyed Jerusalem and to erect a pagan temple on the site of the burned-down Jewish temple. Now, the response of the Jews of Israel, they rebelled once more under the leadership of Bar Kokhba. So this revolt is also called the Bar Kokhba Revolt, the second Jewish revolt. It took 3 years before the Romans succeeded in putting down this bloody uprising. Don Cassius, he's a Roman historian. Don Cassius states that about 580,000 Jews fell by the sword, not counting those who perished from starvation, disease, and related causes. And many others were sold as slaves. Hadrian now carried out his plans. He carried them out in the belief that he would extinguish forever all Jewish hopes for the restoration of a national homeland. So a new city was built on the ruins of Jerusalem, and he named it Aelia Capitolina. And we have a map of Aelia Capitolina. This is a 6th century Medeba map of Jerusalem. It was found in the ancient city of Medeba in Jordan, just to the east of Jerusalem, across the Jordan River. And Jerusalem is right here, inside that red oval. That is the city of Jerusalem in a, of course, a very graphic way, kind of a top view. And you can see running through the center of the city the Roman Cardo. Now, the Cardo was the main marketplace of the city. This is very typical for Roman cities to have this very straight main street running from end to end of the city. So there's the Cardo and Jerusalem as it looked in the 6th century. Here is a drawing. Where it's an accurate drawing of how the Cardo probably looked. You see, it was an economic area, a lot of booths set up by merchants as they bought and sold wares. Here's another drawing of the Cardo, and you can see a very straight city, a very straight street right through the middle of the city with the booths on either side. Now, there's something wrong with this picture. Can anyone spot what's wrong in this picture? I'll give you a second or two. Anyone see it? All righty. Look for the red circle. Look at that young Jewish man. He's wearing his baseball cap backward, and he's got his backpack on. Right. So the artist was very clever here. You'd have never spotted that. You'd have been looking at this picture, and all of a sudden it would have jumped out. What's with that kid? So I think this is a great picture with this little kid in a time warp there. So there's the Cardo.
He's entering this time zone.
He's entering a new time zone, yes. And this is the remains of the Cardo. If you go to Jerusalem and go walk down through the city, you will come across the Cardo. These are the Roman level of restoration, and you can see some of the columns that have been re-erected in place. So the remains of the Cardo are still there. The remains of Aelia Capitolina are still there. Yes?
Yeah, you know where Beit Shan is?
Beit Shan, yes. That's northern, yes.
I noticed when we were there,
yes,
a long street. Was that a Cardo?
Exactly, yes. If you go to Beit Shan, you will walk down that main street. That's the Cardo of Beit Shan, yes. Yeah, that's a very prominent feature of that city. It's really a neat place. All right, so there's Aelia Capitolina and the remains of it today. So he rebuilt the city as a Roman city, and he reared a pagan temple on the site of the old Jewish temple. An edict was issued prohibiting, on pain of death, any Jew from entering or even approaching the vicinity of the new city. The name of the province of Judea was changed to the name Syria Palestina. The name Palestine was given to the land of Israel following the failure of the Bar Kokhba revolt. Now, in the interval between the end of the Bar Kokhba revolt and the Muslim invasion, Israel enjoyed a time of peace from outside invasion and a measure of prosperity. Now, in approximately 395 AD, the extensive territories of the Roman Empire became divided into the Eastern and Western Roman Empires. Here is a map of the Roman Empire at its height in 117 AD. In approximately 395, the empire was divided right about along that line there. It was divided into the Eastern Roman Empire with Byzantium as the capital, and the Western Roman Empire with Rome as the capital. And for the next 250 years, Israel was part of the eastern part of the empire. So here's another map. The Western Roman Empire is seen in orange here, the Eastern Roman Empire in red, and of course, Israel is just a small province as part of the Eastern Roman Empire. Now, you'll hear this era referred to as the Byzantine era, 395 AD to 634 AD, the Byzantine era. The modern name for this time period was derived from the name of the capital city of the eastern branch of the Roman Empire, the capital city Byzantium. Now, this city, which gave the era its name, was rebuilt and adopted as the capital city of the eastern branch of the Roman Empire by Constantine I. Constantine I officially called his capital New Rome, but it was commonly referred to as Constantinople. And from all that comes the name, the time period is called the Byzantine era. Now, the Jews in Palestine were concentrated during this period in Galilee. There they formed the majority of the population. The number of Jews in Palestine in the 7th century is estimated to be about 200,000. Now, page 45, middle of the page, we come to 634 to 1099, the Arab period. So this long era of external peace and relative prosperity came to an end in 634 with the conquest of Palestine by the Arabs. The Muslim followers of Muhammad poured out of the deserts of the Arabian Peninsula. 634 AD, you can see Israel on the left, the Arabian Peninsula on the right, and the armies of Muhammad then came out and entered into the land of Israel en masse for the first time. There were always scattered Arabs in the area and in the land, but this is the first time Arabs came in en masse. Now, within 100 years, the Muslim armies overran vast spaces extending from Central Asia through Northern Africa, the Spanish Peninsula, to the very borders of Southern France. And here is a map of the advance of Islam. The Byzantine Empire is the purple, and the Islamic territory at Muhammad's death is basically the Arabian Peninsula. Then the hash marks show you the expansion of the territory from 632 to 661. Central Asia, off on our left, Northern Africa, across Egypt and Tripoli, Tunis, Fez, Morocco, then up north through the Spanish Peninsula to the very borders of southern France. So this whole area has been dominated by Islam for many, many years. In the borders of southern France, the Arab onrush was brought to a halt by Charles Martel, King of France. Now, during the Arab period, the Jews lived in all parts of Palestine and derived their livelihood from agriculture and handicrafts. Tiberias was a Jewish center in the 7th and 8th centuries. There were important Jewish settlements in Lydda, Ramla, Ashkelon, Caesarea, and Gaza. And some Jews took up residence in Jerusalem. There was a revival of Jewish religious life in Palestine, probably under the stimulus of the vigorous intellectual activity encouraged by the Umayyad and Abbasid caliphs. It was a time of Islamic prominence. Yes?
Backtracking just a little bit, the Arab onrush,
About, well, let's back up here. About 750, I believe it is.
Okay, so starting in 634, the Arabs started to come in.
Yeah, and you can see from the map here, it began around 632 to 634, and the expansion was ended about 750 at the at southern France.
So they basically took residence there and multiplied.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. All right. Many of the synagogue hymns that are still sung today in the synagogue were works of Palestinian poets in this time period. Now, after the decline of the two great Talmudic centers in Babylon and the expiration of the Babylonian exile ark, Palestine once again became the spiritual center of Jewry. The head of the Jerusalem yeshiva was called the Gaon of Jacob, and he was recognized as the religious authority for all Jews living in the territory ruled by the Fatimid dynasty. The Jewish sect of the Karaites, who rejected the Talmudic regulations of Jewish life, established in Jerusalem an ascetic brotherhood called the Mourners of Zion, and they made Jerusalem the center of their movement. However, the number of Jews in the Arab period was not large. The political unrest and the natural catastrophes which visited Palestine in that period impoverished the economic resources of the Palestinian Jews and reduced their numbers.
What's the difference between a Jew and a Palestinian Jew?
Well, that's the ones living in the land called Palestine. Now, there were Jews living in Spain, there were Jews living in North Africa, etc. These are Palestinian Jews. All right, the next period, 1099 to 1291. On page 46, the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem. With the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, we come to the period of the Crusades. The period of the Crusades. And here is a map of the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem during the between the First and Second Crusades. You can see it right here. And it's a province bounded by the Emirate of Damascus on the east side, the Fatimid Caliphate in Egypt, the county of Tripoli to the north. So again, it's a the Latin kingdom, the Crusader kingdom of Jerusalem. Now, the Crusades were motivated by three sets of circumstances. Number one, political. Europe was ready to expand its territory. Secondly, economic. It was desirable to establish commercial relations with the rich East. And thirdly, religious. There was a sense of solidarity felt by Christendom in the West towards the Byzantine state representing Christendom in the East. So there existed a highly emotional desire to deliver the Holy Land of Christendom from the hands of the Muslims. And so there were several crusades. The first one began in 1096. Jerusalem was captured in 1099, and this was not good news for the Jewish people. The conquest of Palestine by the Crusaders was followed by massacres of the Jews. The Crusader kingdom continued until the death of Guy de Lusignan. He was the last king of the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem. Here's a portrait of Guy de Lusignan. This is considered a romantic portrait of him. I don't know if we know exactly what he looked like, but there's a crusader, the face of a crusader. Now, after he was defeated by Saladin in 1187 at the Battle of the Horns of Hattin, Palestine became divided into the Christian and the Muslim states. And finally, Jerusalem surrendered to Saladin in October 1187. And the period closed in 1291. Question. Yes. The Christian Crusaders. Yes, the Christian Crusaders massacred the Jews. For example, when the Crusaders conquered Jerusalem, they herded all the Jews into the large synagogue, set it on fire, and marched around it singing, "Christ, we adore you," as the Jews burned inside.
Was it because they believed that the Jews...
killed Christ. Kill a Jew and save your soul.
Right.
And so they massacred Jews in Europe on the way to the Crusades. Why not save your soul right away? You know, these Christ killers. This was the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. Yeah. Yes, hi. Long time no see.
I was looking in and after work, my TV's
Jewish babies can you get on your sword?
Well, I'm not familiar with that particular detail, but I wouldn't doubt it. It was a gruesome era. And, of course, these crusaders were not believers. They were people under the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. They just did what they thought was proper. And it's a very sad part of Christian, quote, Christian history. All right, page 47. We now come to 1291 to 1516, the period of the Mamluks. Period of the Mamluks. The word Mamluk means slave. The reason for this name lay in the fact that they were foreign slaves. Some of them were Turkish, others were Circassian in descent. 47 Mamluk sultans reigned in the space of 276 years. Only one family retained power for four successive generations. Most of the others lasted only for a period of a few years. Some were insane, others were illiterate. Many came to the throne by assassinating the predecessor, and then they were murdered themselves. Yet in spite of this, the Mamluks repelled successive invasions by the Mongols, and they completed the liquidation of the Latin colonies in the Near East. They drove the final crusaders out. Now, during this period of time, there was a constant trickle of Jewish immigrants to Palestine during this era. All right, now in the middle of page 47, 1517 to 1917, the period of the Ottoman Empire. While the Mamluk Empire was decaying from within, the Osmanli Turks, better known as the Ottoman Turks, were moving to the forefront of events in Asia. And here you can see a map of the Ottoman Empire. This map is in your on page 47. The Ottoman Empire began in that little red spot in Turkey and expanded gradually over time to encompass a very, very large area. And of course, Israel is just a little province that's part of the Ottoman Empire. Now, in 1453, Constantinople fell to their arms, and thus came to an end the eastern division of the Roman Empire. The eastern division collapsed there. In 1517, under the leadership of Selim I, Syria, Palestine, and Egypt were overrun. In the beginning of the Ottoman rule, Syria and Palestine were rearranged for administrative purposes. Palestine, as under previous regimes, did not form a single administrative unit. Jerusalem, Nablus, Gaza, Sidon, and Beirut constituted one unit, while Galilee became part of the Pashalik of Sidon. Now, for defensive reasons, Suleiman the Magnificent rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem, and they're said to be the same walls surrounding the old city to this day. So here's a picture I took from the Mount of Olives, and you can see these Ottoman walls built by Suleiman on top of Herodian foundations. And you can see they're quite long. This is the old city walls from this particular vantage point. We'll get in a little closer. Here you can see those walls. Again, Herodian foundations to them. Here's a close-up of the corner. The small stones are Suleiman's construction. Here again you can see the Golden Gate. Now it actually sits above the ancient Golden Gate from the first century. Below this one, literally below this gate, is the ancient gate. And those small stones you see that make up the wall, those are not Herodian stones. Those are the stones the Suleiman used to construct this wall. So that's a little peek at the ancient walls that surround the old city today, again created by Suleiman the Magnificent. Now, in the first 200 years of Turkish occupation, Palestine, while ravaged by incessant internal wars, experienced no invasion from the outside. The first invasion from the outside came at the very end of the 18th century during the Napoleonic Wars. So the Napoleonic Wars, of course, were led by the good old Napoleon Bonaparte, Emperor of France, I believe. And he's quite famous for his conquests, but he was not successful in conquering Palestine and this area of the Ottoman Empire. He occupied Egypt until in July of 1798, And then he crossed into Palestine in the beginning of 1799. What's going on in America at this time? Revolutionary War, right. He took Jaffa, and he moved on to Tyre, where he laid siege to the city, but he failed to capture Tyre. Jerusalem was never attacked by Napoleon. In June, Napoleon recrossed into Egypt, and in August 1799, he left for Europe, defeated. Now, Turkish policy was favorable to the Jews in general. The Turks probably aimed to attract the Jews from the oppression of the European countries in order that the Turkish Empire would benefit from Jewish economic activities. So accordingly, Palestine received a sizable influx of Spanish Jews when the Jews were driven from Spain in 1492. That was an area of refuge for us. Galilee was still the center of Jewish population in Palestine, and Safed, or Sfat, was the most important city where Jews developed a thriving wool weaving industry. So here's a map on the left of modern Israel. The box surrounds Galilee, and to the that's on the left. On the right, we have Galilee, and the modern city of Safed or Sfat is still there today in Upper Galilee.
What did you say they started up there?
A wool weaving industry.
I know it's very much artisans.
Yeah, today it's artisans. Yeah. Yeah. Right, yeah. It's kind of a New Age area today. We'll find out why in just a moment. Yeah. Yeah, I think if I moved to Israel, I'd like to live in Sfat. It's elevated, gives you a beautiful view, cool weather. Very nice.
Was that time when the Spanish Jews came to Israel? Was that during the Inquisition?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, right. During the Exposition. We were expelled in 1492, and the Spanish Inquisition was a. Where did the Jews go?
Yeah,
in 1492? Many went to the Ottoman Empire. Many went to Northern Africa. Okay.
So you're saying the Inquisition lasted till 1492?
Oh, the Inquisition lasted much longer than that.
Really?
The Inquisition followed us to the New World. The Inquisition went into what's called Mexico today, and many Jewish people fled north into what's known as Arizona and New Mexico today. And there are many people in Arizona and New Mexico who are Jewish and don't even know it because their family fled north and hid their identity.
So what date would you say
that it ended? Oh, I don't know the official year of the Inquisition. Officially dissolved in 1992. Okay, yeah. It's gone on for quite a while. Yeah. So there's many, like I said, Jewish people. In fact, many students in this class have discovered their Jewish heritage. You know, Latino students that discovered, I have Jewish heritage. You know, yeah. Right, exactly.
And they're
Messianic Jews. Right, right. Okay, just one more question, then we got to move on.
Yeah, no, just a question, but to validate about Jewish. So I've got a friend of mine that went to Jerusalem for 7 months. It's a DNA test, figured out he was a tribe of Jew. His last name was Salinas. They went, you know, so the Jews were chased to Spain. From Spain, they wound up going to Mexico.
Right, right.
You know, and then there's a lot of towns, maybe, you know, big families are named after.
Exactly. And the Inquisition followed, yeah. Exactly. All righty. All right, Sfat, or Safed. Safed was also known as the center of Jewish mysticism. In Safed lived Joseph Caro, Spanish-born Jew who was raised in Turkey. Caro combined his Jewish mysticism with a knowledge of the Talmud. It was he who composed the Shulchan Aruch, which is a book designed to regulate the daily life of the Jew in accordance with rabbinic teachings. A Jerusalem Jew, Isaac Luria, also was active in Sfat. And under Isaac Luria's leadership, the Zohar became the absorbing study of Jewish mysticism. So Safed had a Jewish population of some 15,000 by the middle of the 16th century. In addition, the city of Tiberias was rebuilt. So here's that same map, and this is the modern city of Tiberias, built in around this time. So when you visit Tiberias, it has a lot of history to it. Jerusalem, interestingly enough, was the third place as the center of Jewish residence and intellectual activity at this time. Hebron, it's on the map right now. Hebron had a small Jewish community which was struggling for survival amidst a powerful and hostile Muslim populace, and that still exists even to today. And so the Ottoman Empire eventually came to an end. This is a map of the Ottoman Empire in 1914. By 1914, it had shrunk down to just the Arabian Peninsula. And then at the end of World War II, 1923, it had retreated to basically Turkey. So the Ottoman Empire was basically gone by the end of World War II. Oh, excuse me, World War I. World War I, yes. All right, so let me give you a summary now of 66 through 1839. Let's see, where are we? We're on page 49. Yeah, it's a lot of years and a lot of very fast. Yes. During all this period of nearly 2,000 years, Palestine was not even a name on the political map of the world. It was a portion of a larger province, whether Roman, Byzantine, Arab, or Turkish. Its people were never conscious of themselves as a national unit, nor did they ever attempt, as they had done earlier and later Israelite days, to form an independent kingdom. At no time in the recorded history of Palestine was the country one independent political state except under the Jews. So Palestine's political identity was destroyed when the Jewish national homeland was destroyed, and when, at the end of the 19th century, the Jews began to return to the country with a renewed determination to rebuild their national homeland, and so Palestine once again reemerged from obscurity. And when in 1948 the State of Israel was reestablished, Palestine again became, after a lapse of 2,000 years, an independent state. So with this background in mind, let's pick up our study of Zionism proper. So we're now at Roman numeral 3 in your outline. Turn to page 53. Page 53. Now, you'll notice that I haven't supplied you with a traditional outline of this study. I've supplied you with a timeline. We're going to work down this timeline year by year, covering the important people and events in chronological order. Now, I'm doing this because previous courses that I've listened to and taken of this nature usually tackle the material topically rather than chronologically. And when that happens, I usually get very lost. I lose my reference point regarding when an event or when a movement got started. So for me, I need a starting point to orient myself. I do better when I see the events unfold step by step, one after the other. So because I wish that others had taught the material chronologically to me, I thought I would give it a try teaching it to you. So we've surveyed the situation in the land of Israel from the first century until 1839. And in 1839, the beginnings of the first modern Zionist movement begin to appear. Now before we get into that, we'll get into that next week, I want you to be familiar with a number of political and economic terms that will be showing up on a regular basis. So turn back to page 50 and 51. Just turn back a page. And on page 50 and 51, I want you to read on your own this little article on democracy, socialism, communism, and capitalism, okay? Because these ideas dominate Jewish thinking during the Zionist period. And these terms will pop up over and over again. So I want you to be familiar with them. So as a little bit of homework, read that short article, okay? Put yourself to sleep tonight reading it. All right, with that said, we'll then pick it up next week at the top of page 53 with the end of exile the modern Zionist movement. And so we'll see you again next week. Let me pray, and then we'll turn you loose here. Father, again, we want to just thank you for your word, and thank you for your work in the life of the Jewish people, sustaining us, vindicating yourself by bringing us back to the land. And now, Lord, as we turn to the details of that restoration, this first restoration from exile, from a worldwide exile, I ask that you help us to grasp the material. Help me to teach it in an interesting way so that we will be able to understand exactly what has happened regarding the modern state of Israel that we view today, that we visit today, that we read about today. So prepare our hearts for all this. We ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you next week.